Okay, we are live here at United Orthodox Synagogues. Today is Wednesday, Wednesday, January 3rd, 2018. And we are at our weekly lunch and learn. We are recording as usual. We're also live on Facebook. And today we are going to be discussing Parshat Shemot. We start the Book of Exodus this week, and we're going to look into the beginning of the life of Moshe to try to get an understanding of how his life began, and some aspects of why those episodes in his life were important in his becoming the future leader of the Jewish people. So we're going to begin, actually, with chapter 2 in the book of Exodus, which is on page 296. I'm also going to hand out one sheet of paper. Everyone could take one and pass, and we'll get to this eventually more towards the end. We have a nice group of people gathering on Facebook Live, so that's lovely. We have people in Israel and Canada and Texas. This is an international class now. This is an international meeting.
World renowned.
Yeah, I'm literally broadcasting all over the world. Okay, so let's just from ways of background, the beginning of the Parsha deals with Paro's plot, if you will, right? The king who knew not Yosef, and his plot to outsmart and to enslave the Jewish people. He was concerned they were becoming too numerous, and so he appointed Sarei Misim, the taskmasters, over them, and they kept increasing, and then ultimately, first then he enslaves them, and then ultimately Paro, the king, says, all right, it's time to kill the firstborn. Right, it's time to kill the firstborn. Not the firstborn. Excuse me. It's time to kill the males, and he goes to the midwives, Shifra and Pua, and they don't listen to him. They listen to God, and they come up with some sort of excuse to Paro that we can't keep up with the Jewish women. They're having too many kids, or at one time, or they're having kids out in the field like animals. We can't keep track of them, and. Then we get to where we are, chapter 2, that tells us about the earliest moments of Moshe's life, actually his birth, okay? So I want to look at just a couple of verses, and as we're looking at those verses, consider the following questions. Oh, before we do that, I have a question here from Facebook. Were the midwives Egyptian? That's an excellent question. It's a big debate amongst the commentaries. Some say they were Jewish. Some say they were Egyptian. It's unclear from the text because it says Mialdot ha'ivriot, which can be translated as the Hebrew midwives or the midwives of the Hebrews. So, excellent question. Unclear as to exactly what the answer is. I think I gave a class about this once. It's probably on the YU Torah. If you look there, I think I discussed this once and the various contextual aspects of each commentary. But it is a debate amongst the commentaries. Aaron, you have a strong opinion on this? That they were what? Not Jewish?
That they were Jewish.
That they were Jewish. Why?
This is just how I always learned it.
Hmm. See what happens when you come to a Torah class. I uproot everything that you've ever thought was true.
Really?
About Judaism. No. It's a debate. Some of the commentaries say
why would
yes,
the Egyptian
no.
midwives go tend Hebrew mothers deliver?
Excellent
so
question.
They can, so
because
they kill
yes, so they can kill them. The meaning Paro, if Paro, if that actually makes perfect sense. If Paro said, I want all the boys killed, mm-hmm. then he is going to provide the means by which to kill them by saying, okay, no more Jewish midwives. All the midwives are going to be ours now. and I have a better chance of making sure that my orders are followed. Now, that didn't work out either.
Right.
But that would be one reason to say that they were Egyptian midwives tending to the Jews.
But see, then I always heard that they were righteous women.
There are righteous Gentiles too, right? We have a whole section of them in Yad Vashem.
Right.
Right. So it depends. If you look at it that way, then this is the first example of
righteous Gentiles.
Righteous Gentiles. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, I think this is the one where he says that this is the first example of civil disobedience.
Hmm.
Right? You have a government telling you to do something and people saying, no, we're not going to do it, and actually risking something.
Right. Right?
Civil disobedience doesn't really make an impact unless you run the risk of some sort of punishment,
right?
Going to jail or worse, right? Or a fine or worse. So this is an example of civil disobedience, whether they're Jews or not Jews. But anyway, there is this debate as to Jewish or not. But that is not our topic. Our topic is Moshe's early life. So let's look.
Rabbi,
yes.
Can I ask one?
Sure.
When did we cross over from being native, whatever we were, to actually all of a sudden being called Jews? When do we cross over?
From being Hebrews to Jews. Well, at this point, for sure, we're called Hebrews, right? Jews is actually related to the English version of Yehudim. And that really is because now what's left over, most of us, were from the tribe of Yehuda.
Right.
So we're called Yehudim. So that change may have taken place when the other tribes were lost.
I was called Hebrew here by Houston.
And the other tribes were lost, but the tribe that wasn't lost was Yehuda, and that's who we're left with.
Not derogatory.
Okay, so let's look. Now let's look at the early, the account of Moshe's birth and when Paro's daughter finds him. Okay, it's on page 296. It's chapter 2, and it's verses 1 through 10. Just that first page, okay? And I want you to, as you look at those psukim, look at them with the intent of finding two separate stories in them, two separate biographies of Moshe. And let's see if we could flesh this out. Okay?
You want us to read them now?
Yeah, take a quick look at the 10 psukim on your own. You could read them in English or in Hebrew. And for those of you watching at home or listening at home, we're in chapter 2 of the book of Exodus. So whatever book you have in front of you, verses 1 through 10. Another 30 seconds. Okay, let's regather here and see if we could identify the biographies of Moshe. So anyone want to give me the first one? Yeah, what's the first one?
His birth.
Right. Which psukim represent his first biography?
From 2 to 4.
All right, or maybe even from 1 to 4, because
right,
number one introduces his parents. One introduces his parents, and then 2 that she gives birth.
three
that they couldn't hide him, and 4. You could put in parentheses, right? So these first 3 or 4 psukim represent Moshe's first biography, right? What would you say about Moshe's first biography? Who does he come from? Who does he belong to?
The House of Levi.
The House of Levi, more generally?
Jews.
The Hebrews, right?
Yeah.
He's Jewish, okay, right? And so therefore he is also part of an oppressed people, right? The people are being already oppressed at this point, and Moshe is part of the oppressed people. And what's the second part of his biography? The rest of the psukim, right, 5 through 10, where he is growing up and educated in the house of Paro. Essentially, he becomes a prince because he is treated as Shula makes a very good point. What did she do?
She named him.
And until I was looking at these psukim again, we've all probably read these psukim dozens and dozens of times, I noticed that something is missing from the first biography of his life,
which is no name.
Right, his mother doesn't even name him. Right, which I found to be so interesting.
His parents aren't.
We don't know. The names are not given here, but Moshe, normally we would expect to, in all the other Bible stories, the husband and wife conceive, and they give birth, and they name. That's always the pattern of all every person who's been born in the Bible, essentially up until now.
The sister couldn't reveal his name, then she'll tell them his identity.
Right, so I'm not talking about revealing. His name. They weren't going to put a little onesie on him that said, "Hi, my name is the future savior of the Jewish people." But they privately didn't even name him.
Right.
Right. They had. It's almost. It
but
sounds
they
like.
Name him at the bris?
Right. It sounds. It sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah.
It sounds like. It sounds like, they didn't name him on purpose.
Yes.
To me. Because maybe they have no hope for his future.
Exactly.
Right? He's a goner. Either they're going to throw him in the water, right, or we're going to put him in this boat, and God knows what's going to happen to him. Like when it's almost as if, like when you name him, you have a better attachment. Oh, remember baby blank? He was so cute. But by not naming him, it's maybe they did it on purpose because they felt that he had no hope. And by naming him, it would have been even more painful for them to get rid of him.
Yeah,
but we don't know.
And then contrast that to the fact that Paro does name him. And we're going to get to what that name means in a moment. But I think that's a very, very important piece of the story. Yeah.
But why would you think that parents wouldn't name him? They might have not mentioned it, but I assume they would have a bris and they would give him a name.
I don't know if there was a bris at this point. There's no mitzvah yet to have a bris.
Oh, no, there isn't.
No, because there's no Torah yet. The Torah hasn't been given yet. It could have been traditional based on Abraham. But the fact that the Torah doesn't tell us, they told us everything else. They told us where the parents are from and that she conceived and he was a good child and she hid him for 3 months. So even if there was a bris, presumably the bris would have happened by now. And she couldn't hide him any longer. And they're into lots of detail. The basket was made of wicker and they smeared it with clay. But they give us a lot of details. They could have stuck in one other detail, right, but they don't. So the fact that that's missing, I think, is significant.
And I think it's also important to understand that children's names revealed either hopes for them, their identity. We see that in retrospect. We see that in forecast. We see that the name becomes very significant. And it is significant. You know, you just don't give a name because it sounds
right. Especially in the Bible. Right now, we usually name after people, after our ancestors. But in the Bible, they often named based on things to come or things that have happened. Right here, it's silence. It's almost as if his name is silence, as if to say silence is going to be important here. There's nothing to say about this kid because
they don't know.
Either we don't know, or maybe worse, they really think they do know, and it's bad.
Yeah, it's bad.
Okay, now who does name him?
Pharaoh's daughter.
Pharaoh's daughter names him. The Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who we've studied here before, he says that the word Moshe means son in the language of in the Arabic language of the time. It means son, meaning Paro's daughter adopts him. Right? If she names him son, right, child, right, she essentially adopts him, and she's basically claiming, I found him in no man's land. Right, halachically you would say that this river that they found him in is hefker. Hefker is what we do to the chametz before Pesach. We say it's hefker, meaning it's
whoever wants it.
It's not mine. I don't care what happens to it anymore. I disown it, right? So the Moshe has been disowned. That's what she's thinking. And by the way, the fact that he's not named may lend itself to that. This kid's been disowned by his parents. They obviously have no hope for him if they stuck him in a little basket and floated him down the river. And so now he's mine. He's legally mine. So not only am I sort of raising him in whatever legal construct they have, it sounds like Paro's daughter really believed that she was the rightful mother. It's almost as if you would go to court, they'd have a real case now. You put your kid up for adoption, someone adopts him, and now you want him back. Well, now who gets him back? That's going to be for the courts to decide. And Paro, by naming him according to the Tziv, by naming him Moshe, is saying, I have rights to this child now because he's been put in Hefke.
What did Levi and his wife thought? Did they give him up?
All we could read is the text, and I'm suggesting that by the fact that they didn't name him,
they gave up.
It could be. I don't want to say for sure, but it could be. I think it's reasonable. It's a reasonable understanding of the psukim that they gave up.
They put him in a Hefke place.
It's reasonable, but. I guess as a parent, you always have hope, but
they actually care
as long as they were hoping to
be alive. Right, so that's a good point. The fact that they sent the
Miriam.
Sister, so right, and the mother became the nursemaid, so maybe that would the wet nurse. So maybe that would lead to a different conclusion. But like I said, shivim panim la Torah. We could read the psukim lots of different ways. Okay, so now the question is: now that we've established that Moshe has two biographies, right? He's not 3 months old yet, and he's 3 months old. He has two biographies. One is he is the child of Hebrews. He comes from a oppressed people. And his second biography, which is he is the prince of Egypt, right? He is Paro's daughter. She may have gone through some sort of, if not legal, sort of quasi-legal steps to adopt him by naming him, what she named him. At least she, according to the Tziv, she felt that way. So Moshe has two different identities.
One identity.
It's a continuation.
It's one identity?
Continuation, yes.
How are they the same?
What?
How are they a continuation? How do you see them as being continuous?
Well, we know that whom he was born to, and he was put in the teva, and somebody adopted him. So
after
what?
The
it doesn't
3 months.
Change his personal identity. It's the same one.
It doesn't change his biological identity, but there are two different stories of his life. One story of his life is I'm from an oppressed people.
Wow.
My parents abandoned me because they had no hope. And the other is I'm at the top of the world.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah, he's been adopted. He's the prince of Egypt.
Just to go back for one
Aaron.
So I think the two stories is important because it sets up a tension.
Okay.
And the tension is resolved here in the next part. The tension is he could have identified himself as an Egyptian growing up in the Pharaoh's household. But we see that he identifies himself as a Hebrew, here by his actions, why and how? That's the question that we have to
so
ask.
So good. I want to get to that question.
Just one more
thing. Why is it important for the Torah to set it up this way? Right. It's very stark, and the question is why? Yeah.
I just want to ask, when you read the text, it says when she took him out of the water, she says, this is one of the Hebrew boys. Only when she went to the nurse, she nursed him, she brought him back, and she called his name Moses. Only when she got him back.
Right.
What,
she didn't name him when she drew him out of the water.
But she did name him.
Oh, okay.
Right.
But
she did. Right. That's interesting why she didn't name him right away.
He might have had a name from his parents.
Well, we don't know it.
No, we don't
know.
The
text doesn't tell us what
it
is. Well,
what was the name that Pharaoh gave him?
Moses.
No, Pharaoh didn't give him a name. Pharaoh's daughter gave him a name.
Okay,
Moshe.
Moshe.
She gave the name.
Yeah, Moshe. Moshe,
yeah.
Okay, so... So why does the Torah, right, have to give us this sort of, again, what I look at as a two-tiered or two stages, even if you don't want to be extreme as I'm being, not two lives, but two stages in his life, and right away, right, it's right in there in those first 10 psukim, almost 50-50. Right, the first four psukim, his life as a Hebrew. The next six psukim, his life as an Egyptian. Why is it like that? So there's a fascinating commentary.
It's interesting. Yeah. That they say, "Vaydam Moshe Vayetzel Echav." Why did they already say Echav?
Right. That's another. We're not even going to get there. We're still back here. That's a good question, though, Shula. Excellent question. So there's an excellent, a fascinating commentary called the Ibn Ezra, who says three very interesting things about this question as to why it is that Moshe's life, you don't have it in front of you, why it is that Moshe's life unfolds this way. First of all, he says, very interesting, he says, we really don't know, the Ibn Ezra is working on an assumption. Ibn Ezra's assumption is that God did it on purpose. Let me back up. The Ibn Ezra's assumption is that maybe God did it on purpose, which is an interesting assumption, because now the Ibn Ezra is taking it, this is not just a coincidence. This is the possibility that God set up Moshe's life to have these two separate versions on purpose. He says, we don't know for sure if God did this, but it's possible that God did this. And the question is why? And even if you don't want to accept that God directly had a hand in this, it's still interesting to understand how maybe this double life affects Moshe's future abilities to lead the Jewish people. So what does Ibn Ezra say? Why may it be? Again, it's interesting, he sort of leaves it hanging. Why may it be that God set it up this way? He says for two reasons. He says the first reason is, and I'll read you some of his Hebrew, Lihiyot nafsho al madrega ha'elyona. Why was it that Moshe goes from being a son of an oppressed people into the house of Paro? Lihiyot nafsho al madrega ha'elyona. So that his soul, his being, would be on the highest level. Velo tiyeh shefela urigila lihiyot bebeit avadim. And not to be depressed and used to being in the house of slaves. Meaning, Moshe grows up with a certain sense of dignity, of self-respect, that you
confidence,
don't...
Too.
Confidence. You don't push people around. Right? Had he grown up as a Beit Eved, if he'd grown up in the house of his parents, he may have never been able to stand up to Paro because he would have been, well, this is the way people are treated. They're pushed around. I'm just one of them. I'm just a regular person who gets pushed around like everyone else. And what is he, and this is what Aaron alluded to later. Halo tireh shaharag ha-mitzri bavur shehu asah hamas. He later goes on, he kills the Egyptian who's beating the Jew. Ibn Ezra is arguing Moshe would never have had the temerity to kill an Egyptian had he grown up as a lowly slave. He would have thought, well, yeah, this guy's going to get beaten up tomorrow. Maybe I'll get beaten up the next day. Today, maybe I'll get beaten up the tomorrow. This is just the way we are. But when Moshe grows up with this sense of dignity and confidence, and no one pushed him around, he was the prince of Egypt, he sees someone else being pushed around. He says, hey, that's not the way it's supposed to be. Vohoshia benot midyan meharoim. And then what happens after that? When he has to run away because he killed the Egyptian, he sees the shepherds who are harassing the Yitro's daughters, right? Yitro's daughters, who he marries one of them eventually, around the well.
And he chases them down.
Bavur sheyu osim chamas lashkot sonam mehamayim shedalu. That they were trying to harass these women who had drawn the water to water their flocks. So the Ibn Ezra says it's possible that God arranged it this way, number one, so that Moshe would have confidence in himself and would have the ability to do all these things. Okay.
So now God is a shadchan
to be a son of the Hebrews to have a sense of justice.
No, exactly. Adarav, no, exactly the opposite, Shula. Had he been a son of Hebrews, he would have maybe felt it was not fair, but he wouldn't have had the chutzpah to do anything about it.
No, but he needed part of being...
We haven't gotten to the second part yet. Now we're only talking about what his Egyptian identity did for him. We're going to get to the Jewish identity in a second. What did his Egyptian identity do? One, it gave him a sense of confidence. But there's something else Ibn Ezra says. And then it says, V'o davar acher. This is really interesting. Another thing. Ki ilu haya gadal ben echav v'yikiruhu min urav. Had he grown up amongst his brethren and had they known him from his childhood, lo hayu yirim mimenu. They would not be in awe of him. Ki yachshavuhu ke'echad mehem. They would have thought that he's just one of them. So it's not only about his self-confidence, it's also about the. It's also about what's the second factor?
The people's reaction to him.
The Jewish reaction to him. Had he been just one of them and he would have shown up and said, hey, I'm going to save you, they would have been like, eh, I knew you when you were a kid, when you were, you know, playing stickball on the street. You're not going to do, you're just one of us. You're nothing special. Right? Right? But now that they see him, oh, he's like an insider outsider, right? He's one of them, but he was bred differently. Maybe they think he knows how to deal with Paro. Maybe they realize that he does have the ability and the self-confidence. So says the Ibn Ezra, we can't be sure why God does anything. But it's possible that God did this, arranged that Moshe would be brought up in Paro's household, so he would have two things going for him. One, self-confidence, and two, the confidence of the people. That they wouldn't, you know, we have a saying, Ein Navi Be'iro.
Right.
Right? There's no such thing as a local prophet. Right? Because someone comes and says, I'm a prophet. They say, you're a prophet. I was your third grade teacher. You know, prophet. You're just a kid, right? So Moshe would have had the same problem. So by growing up out of the sight of the Jews, and all of a sudden he shows up, he says, hey, I'm one of you. He carries himself differently. Maybe he dressed differently. Maybe he spoke Egyptian. A lot of things about him. Yeah. They have confidence in him. Shula.
What does it mean that Moshe says to himself, Achen oda davar? What is the davar? The davar that he...
Seems that the davar is that he killed the Egyptian, yeah.
Or maybe he was told that he was actually not...
Not a Jewish. Could be. Yeah, could be.
He's adopted.
But we still have our second question to answer. Our second question is, what does his Jewish identity add?
His mother probably, when she was nursing him, probably talked to him. She didn't just nurse him.
But he's 3 months old.
Yeah, but she had him for several years. He didn't.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, but
it says so here. It says the mother taught him a couple of...
What does his Jewish identity do? We know now his Egyptian identity, according to Ibn Ezra, and Ibn Ezra is not the only one who says this. The Ralbag says this, almost the exact same thing, that his Egyptian identity helped him with his own self-confidence and with believability.
Well, I'm sure.
Right? What is the fact that he comes from, let's say, an oppressed people. How does that affect his ability to lead the Jews in the future?
Compassion.
Ah, okay, good. So let's think about it this way, right? We notice that Moshe's life story is a miniature version of what the Jews are going through. Right? What happens? Moshe is exiled from his home. He's a little baby. He's exiled from his home. And he is forced to live and grow up away. Moshe is an exile, even though everyone's in Egypt. But Moshe is an exile, just like the rest of the people. So I think Marilyn's point is correct. I mean, the only someone who sort of feels that same sense of displacement and that sense of unfairness, right, is able to really appreciate and understand what they're going through. And this is, I think, strengthened by the fact that if, in fact, his mother did nurse him for a few years, it's possible that the whole time he's growing up in Paro's house, he knows he's been stolen.
Could be.
Right? He knows. And that's why it says in the beginning of the third chapter that he goes out to his brethren. What do you mean he goes out to his brethren? I thought he was an Egyptian prince. He never felt he was an Egyptian prince. Meaning this whole time he's growing up with a sense of resentment to this woman, Paro's daughter. It's true, you've given me a wonderful life, but I don't belong here. The fact is, my mother's been telling me all this time, maybe, that I'm her son, and I know I don't look like your other sons, right? There's something going on. And so Moshe feels this same sense of displacement. He actually goes through it and feels it, and then that's why he's able to go out and see the Egyptian beating the Jew, and right away say, I'm on his side, because I know I don't belong with these other people. It's hard for me to believe that that's when it clicked. That's maybe when he made his first decision, but there must have been something lingering in the back of his mind all these years that I don't belong in this house. I don't belong in this palace. I'm not people.
It looks like he's a justice man, a man of just, because it tells you that he went and saw people are suffering. Happened to be his brothers. That's a commentary within the text.
Right.
And he saw an Egyptian is hitting a Hebrew brother.
Right, but who is he?
But I don't believe he felt brotherhood.
But it says Echad, the Torah.
People are suffering.
But it says,
and it comes as a
it says, the Torah says that he went out to his brothers.
His brethren.
Was said because they said was.
Okay, that could be. That's a fair read. I think it could go both ways. I think one point is when the Torah calls them his brothers, there are two ways to look at it.
Metaphorically.
That's the way the Torah views it, but not Moshe.
Or maybe
that's the way Moshe. I think it could be both. I think that's a good point. In any case, it could be, right, that Moshe is feeling the same sense of injustice, right? His life already has paralleled the life of Bnei Yisrael. And there's also something else. This is also interesting. We could thank Paro's daughter for this. Moshe, regardless of whether or not he appreciated or resented being brought up in the house of Paro's daughter, at the end of the day, he is the recipient of a great act of kindness on the part of Paro's daughter. Right? Paro's daughter saves his life, literally saves his life, and raises him. And he is now able to recognize that act of kindness saved my life. I have the capacity to do the same thing. It's almost as Moshe becomes Bat Paro. Right? And so Moshe's life parallels the life of the Jewish people and parallels the life of Paro's daughter. It parallels the life of Jewish people because he is an exile himself. He's forced to live in out of his freedom, right? And on the other hand, he gets to mimic Paro's daughter, who plucked him out of the Nile and saved his life, and he is able to save the life of the Jewish people, and so that's the tension, I think, that the Torah is trying to give us. On the one hand, there are positive aspects that Moshe gets from living in that palace. There are things that he resents from living in that palace, things that help him become a better or an able redeemer because of the difficult and the positive experience that he's gone through in his life. And I just want to make one other point before we conclude. A big part of Moshe's, I guess we'll call it transition, is going from someone who is completely passive to being active, right? Obviously, for no fault of his own, at the beginning of his life, he's completely passive, right? He's 3 months old. There's not much he can do. But he's completely passive, and we don't really read about Moshe doing anything particularly... Forget it. We don't read about Moshe doing anything until that moment. However old he is, when he walks out of the palace and sees the Egyptian hitting the Jew, up until that point, he was completely passive. And the Jew, and whatever was going on, and he was either paying no attention to it, whatever reason, he's completely passive. All of a sudden, he becomes an active participant in his future, right, and in the future of the Jewish people.
He has an agenda.
All of a sudden, right. And then, but there's also, there's something else. Look at Pasuk 24 in chapter 2. I'm sorry, no, this is, yeah, chapter 2, verse 24. 24 and 25. Actually, could go back to 23 even. Page 300. During those many days, Vayehi Bayamim Harabim Haheim, Bayamat Melech Mitzrayim. So now there's another king that dies, right? Vayeyanchu Vinei Yisrael Min Havodah, Vayezaku Vatal Shavatam El Elohim Min Havodah. Right? A lot of time has gone by. So much time, I think the Torah is trying to tell us, that a paro has died. And now, finally, the Jewish people start crying. And they start crying out to God. And then look what happens. Vayar Elohim et Bnei Yisrael vayeda Elohim. God saw the children of Israel, and God knew. Well, what does that mean? That all these other years God didn't know that they were enslaved. All of a sudden now, because
he took his names in order to.
Well, what's? I mean, it's strange. What changed? What changed? All of a sudden now God decides to pay attention, because this is where the redemption story starts.
It's a new sheriff there in town.
But what?
Maybe the new pharaoh was harsher.
So, wait,
I'll take care of my people.
So because the old pharaoh died,
right.
Why would that matter?
Yeah.
The new
why pharaoh. Would that matter?
Because it's a new leader coming up.
But we already have a new
God
leader.
God said, wait a minute, but I can do something.
It's a good point, but we already have a new leader.
Maybe he was
the
harsher.
First time. Vayakam Melech Hadash al Mitzrayim Asher Yehuda Yosef. So we have three paros we know of. The one who was Yosef's friend. Then a new one arises who doesn't know Yosef, and he enslaves the Jewish people. And this guy. So why does God wait for this guy?
Probably because now God created a leader to be for the Jews. He prepared him.
So it has not, so, ah, so it's not about it's not about the dead it's not about the dead paro, it's about Moshe's readiness. It's about Moshe's readiness. Okay, could be coincidental. Okay. Anyone else want to venture a guess?
Or this paro was worse than the other paro.
It could be, although that's troubling, because then what we're saying is God really was only going to redeem the people when it got really bad. When it was only an 8 on the pain scale, he wasn't giving them pain medication.
That's normal.
Only when it, right. So that's difficult.
But that's an agadah. That it got worse.
We're trying to understand the verses, right? We're trying to explain it. So,
and Gematria says it's the year, too. In Gematria, wasn't it the numbers were significant?
Yes.
That it was so many years in slavery.
So, okay, it could be that a number of years passed by for things to get kicked in. Okay. I'm suggesting that the Torah, there's a different lesson here. Okay. I'm suggesting a different lesson here, and this is where we come to this piece of paper that I handed out.
Redemption is not.
Okay. I'm suggesting that this goes back to what I said earlier about the passive and active message. And that is that until the Jewish people decided to become active and take a role in their own salvation, God wasn't going to do anything. Now, that in and of itself is difficult, I understand, okay?
So you mean he,
hold on one second.
Cried,
that, yes, exactly.
That means they became active?
Right, yes.
By crying?
Yes. I'll explain, right? Meaning, it's now, I want to avoid getting into whether or not this is just or not, and just focus on the message it may teach us. It may teach us a general message, which is, we're not supposed to rely on God just doing everything. We, right, we're obligated to take an active role, right? And here, it could be, it's a good point, that all they did was cry. They didn't rebel. They didn't revolt. But up until now, if you notice, in the first two chapters of Exodus, there's nothing. In the first chapter of Exodus, there's total silence on behalf of the Jewish people. And a lot of time passes, right? It says, Vayehi Bayamim Harabim, page 300. A lot of time has passed. The Torah is telling us a lot of time has passed. And the Jewish people haven't even thought to cry out and say, what's going on? Rabbi Soloveitchik, in the beginning of an essay, a great essay called Redemption Prayer in Talmud Torah, makes the point. Let's read just a few sentences. Start on the page that says 55. He says, redemption is a fundamental category in Judaic historical thinking and experiencing. Our history was initiated by a divine act of redemption, right? The Exodus from Egypt. And we are confident we'll reach its finale in a divine act of ultimate redemption. That's the Messiah. What is redemption? Redemption involves a movement by an individual or a community from the periphery of history to its center. Or to imply a term from physics, redemption is a centripetal movement. To be on the periphery means to be non-history-making entity, while movement toward the center renders the same entity history-making and history-conscious. Naturally, the question arises, what is meant by a history-making people or community? A history-making people is one that leads a speaking, storytelling, communing-free existence, while a non-history-making, non-history-involved group leads to a non-communing and therefore silent, unfree existence. Rabbi Soloveitchik's point is the first step to freedom is your voice, is your ability to say, I don't like this. And that's what happens right here. It's not the only step. You're right. You need more. But the first step, I'll get you a second, Aaron. The first step to freedom is the voice. And if you turn to the next page, he talks about that slaves live in silence. Number three. Redemption, we have stated, is identical with communing or with the revelation of the word, the emergence of speech. When a people leaves a mute world and enters a world of sound, speech and song, it becomes a redeemed people, a free people. In other words, a mute life is identical with bondage. A speech-endowed life is a free life. And this is why we take freedom of speech so seriously in this country. Right? If you can't say what you want to say, you're not really free. The slave's life is silence. If such a meaningless existence may be called life, he has no message to deliver. In contrast with the slave, the free man bears a message, has a good deal to tell, and is eager to convey his life story to anyone who cares to listen. No wonder the Torah has four times emphasized the duty of the father, a liberated slave, right at the Pesach Seder, to tell his children born into freedom the story of liberation. Free man who is eager to tell a story is always surrounded by an audience willing to listen to a story. The slave has neither a story nor a curious audience. Moreover, he is not merely a speechless being, but a mute being, devoid not only of the word, but of the meaningful sound as well. So when the Jews start to have their voice heard, that's really the beginning of the redemption. That's when God is stepping in. I don't think it means God was ignoring them until then, but this is when the story really starts. When the story of the redemption really starts, when the Jews realize we have a voice, we can cry out. Maybe the only thing they felt they could do was cry out to God, because the Egyptians certainly were going to listen to them, but at least they started to do something. And they move like at one point you have Pharaoh's daughter. She's sitting in the river. She has a choice. I could be passive or active. I could let this baby run by, or I could actively do something and save his life. She saves his life. Moshe too. He goes out around his brothers. She sees a Jew in trouble. He sees a Jew in trouble. Just like Pharaoh's daughter saw a Jew in trouble. He had a choice. He could have been passive and let the Egyptian kill the Jew, or like his mother, adopted mother, right, take him out of the water. He saved the Jew. And now the Jews make the same choice. We ourselves in trouble. We could just say, this is just going to be our lot forever. Or we could take an active role. The most we could do, at least, is cry out to our God, and they do that. So this whole move of that we see of Moshe's life keys us into a few things. It gives us an insight into his double personality, that he needed to have a strong personality so he himself would stand up to Paro. He needed to be trusted as a strong leader by the Jewish people. This is why his Egyptian heritage is important. His Jewish heritage is important is because he himself needed to be an exiled member of a enslaved people who himself was the recipient of kindness in order to understand the power of that, and also the lesson of moving from passive to to active. All of these things are intertwined in this double story of his life, and that's what ultimately leads to the formation of Moshe as the leader that he ultimately became.
Can I ask
you what? Sure.